13 and 14 tell the famous story of the sending out of the spies into the land to gauge what was ahead of the people of God. In the words of Moses at verse 18 of chapter 13, the spies had to go in and see what the land was, whether the people who dwelt in it were strong or weak, whether they were few or many, whether the land that they dwelt in was good or bad, whether the cities that they dwelt in were camps or strongholds, and whether the land was rich or poor, and whether there was any wood in it or not. And then he finishes with these resounding words, "Be of good courage and bring some of the fruit of the land." And so these 12 men went out as a body, and they scoured the land, and it was quite a fantastic expedition, because according to the geographical report here, they went right through the whole land of Palestine, right past the Sea of Galilee. I wonder what their thoughts were as they passed the Sea of Galilee, right up to Hamath, which is near modern Damascus and the land of Syria. And 12 men came back. But when they came back, they were no longer one body, because they came back divided. You see, all 12 of them had seen the same things. Milk and honey, the fertility of the land, the great possibilities, the opportunities, and the cities walled up to heaven, which he'd never seen before, because there are no cities walled up to heaven when you are wandering through a wilderness. And of course, the sons of Anak, the descendants of the giants, they all saw the same things. But the interpretation that they put on what they had seen divided the 12 men. And the challenge this evening is this. It was a case of 2 against 10. It was Caleb and Joshua against 10. 2 men with good news and a cheering word against 10 men with long faces and faithless hearts. And the question that keeps pushing its way forward to the forefront right throughout these chapters is this: whose side are you on? Whose side are you on tonight in the Christian warfare? Are you on the side of the 2? Or are you on the side of the 10? Because that is the division in the Lord's work today. Christians today are surrounded with problems such as have not confronted the Christian church for many, many years. I need hardly speak about them. The moral and the spiritual decay of our generation. The umpteen kinds of death. Vehement opposition to Christ, sometimes in the churches. And what is perhaps worse than opposition to Christ, the monumental indifference of the multitudes. And in the middle of that, Christ is calling men and women today to be Calebs and Joshuas, people of faith, people of good hope, and people of good courage. And over against these two men, you had the 10 men with the long faces and the unbelieving hearts. And the question obtrudes right through the two chapters. Whose side are you on tonight? You see, this entire story of the spies circles round three pairs of paradoxes. And the first is the paradox of optimism and pessimism in the work of Christ. Now, I think you'll admit that there is that tension between optimism and pessimism in all evangelical activity. The pessimism is this, that you know in your heart that however hard you try, not everyone is going to be saved. Jesus never promised that everyone was going to be saved. In fact, it was Jesus who said that great numbers of people are going to be lost and die and go to a lost eternity forever and ever and ever, because hell lasts as long as heaven. If heaven's going to last forever, hell is going to last forever. And you know that even amongst those who are going to yield to Christ and respond to the claims of the gospel, not all of them are going to go on to consecration. You see, it's one thing to be a Christian and saved. It's another thing to be a consecrated Christian. Somebody who's out and out for Jesus. A firebrand for Jesus. A burn all your bridges behind you person for Jesus. Are you that kind of Christian? Or are you one of these fringy people? These peripheral Christians who forever sit on the outside and look in. You know all that. And that's part of the pessimism that you find, that you inevitably find in Christian work. But at the heart of that pessimism, there is evangelical optimism, because it's the very optimism of Jesus himself. Jesus was an optimist. He could see with the eye of faith beyond the garden and beyond the bloody sweat and beyond the pain and the tears and the anguish and beyond the cross and beyond the rejection. He saw through them all to the empty grave and the resurrection morning and his own coronation. This is how the writer to the Hebrews puts it at the start of chapter 12. He says that we are to live our lives looking unto Jesus, the pioneer and finisher of faith, who, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and is now set down at the right hand of the Majesty on high. Can you take in these words? It was for the joy that was set before him that Christ endured the cross and despise the shame. That's optimism. That is evangelical optimism. And it's a word of hope and a word of good courage in these dark times. Can you see the tension between pessimism, the dark view, and optimism, the bright view in Christian life? Can you see this tension in your own heart, the one pulling against the other? And can you see the tension in Christian work today, the pull of the dark view against the bright view? It was the utter tragedy of these 10 men that, having seen the same challenges in the land as the other two saw, Caleb and Joshua, the walled cities and the tall inhabitants. You know, the word anak is the Hebrew word for your neck. And as they looked up to them, they thought they were giants because they had long necks. Anakim really means the people with the long necks. Tall inhabitants. And it was the tragedy of the 10 that they were pessimists, because they held the dark view. Without faith, without optimism, without hope, and without courage at its heart. Well, if that's not a challenge to us tonight, facing the Christian scene, I don't know what is. Churches are closing, of course. And they'll go on closing. And I can face that fact with cheerfulness. Mercy on my soul. The future of the work of Christ doesn't depend on buildings. I was listening to Tom Robertson of St. James's Broughty Ferry preaching when I was on holiday. And in his sermon he pointed out that in the city of Dundee, in the past 25 years, 19 churches have been closed. And as I drove over Glasgow, the south side of Glasgow, I counted over 30 churches that had been closed. I can face that with courage and optimism. The numbers of children being baptized are tumbling down, down, down. Did you know that last year in this church, only 2 children were baptized? And one of them was that bonny wee lad, Dean Wilkie, whom the Lord gathered to himself a few weeks ago. And this year, it's the same story. Only 2 children have been baptized this year. And all over Scotland, very, very few people are professing faith and coming to the Lord's Supper, so that the roll of the Church of Scotland is now falling by 10,000 a year. And of course, most youth fellowships have passed away, and Sunday school numbers are declining, and youth organizations have to struggle along. But whose side are you on? The 2 or the 10? Are you a pessimist because you see nothing but walled cities and giants in the land? Or can you not see that at the heart of pessimism there is the optimism of Christ, which is based on the sovereignty of God, and which says that the future belongs to Jesus Christ? Things are going God's way, whatever the evidence to the contrary. And the challenge to Christians tonight is to be optimists and embrace the promises of God and walk into the land and walk into the future and claim it for Christ. Secondly, alongside that tension between optimism and pessimism, there lies the second tension. You know, of course, that the early books of the Bible say over and over and over again that the land was given to Israel. It already belonged to her. Before she went in, it was hers. Time and time again, God says, I've given you the land. I will give you the land. This is the land which I swore to your fathers to give you. It's yours. It's your land. But pulling against that, there's the other half of the paradox, which is that you have the command to go in and possess the land. It was already theirs, but they had to possess it, make it their own, and claim their heritage. And that too is a tension in the individual Christian life and in the public work of Christ. There is a tension, on the one hand, between the givenness of the land. Your heritage is given to you. Your inheritance is given to you. And on the other hand, there is the absolute necessity to lay hands on what is already yours. There remaineth much land to be possessed. Land to be possessed. What a tension. What a wonderful paradox. The New Testament equivalent of it is found in Ephesians, where Christ is held up as the heritage of the church. Christ is the Christian's inheritance. There is a givenness of Christ in the gospel, like the land. He's yours. But it will take all the energy you have to possess your inheritance. And you can spend the rest of your entire life ransacking the riches that are yours in Christ. Christ is given, but you must go in and claim your heritage. And it's the teaching of the New Testament that all that you will ever need to get you to heaven is found in the Christ who is given to sinners. If you want cleansing, you'll find it there. If you want forgiveness, you'll find it there. If you want grace or holiness or sanctification or renewal, you will find it in the land which the Lord your God gives you. Christ is the heritage and the inheritance of the Christian. And of course, over against that, there's the second half of the paradox in Ephesians, which is that the Christian is Christ's heritage. God has not only given Christ to us, God has given us to Christ. And Christ wants to explore you just as he wants you to explore him. Have you discovered this tension yet? That Christ is yours. All of him is yours. He is your birthright and your dowry from God. And you are his to be explored, ransacked by him for use in his service. The tension between the givenness of the land and the need to go in and be brave and possess it. There's a third paradox here. Actually, the three pairs really stand together. Evangelical pessimism pulling against evangelical optimism. The givenness of your spiritual heritage pulling against the need laid on you to enter into it. And the third paradox is the paradox of faith pulling against unfaith. Three men now, actually. First of all, Moses in chapter 13 and verse 20. He says, go and see whether the land is rich or poor, whether there's wood in it or not. And these heartening words, be of good courage. You know that that's the French word, cœur. Courage has to do with your heart. La cœur, the French for the heart. Be of good courage. And these lovely words, bring some of the fruit of the land. We want to see now what's ahead of us. I want it now. Be of good courage. That's faith. Caleb in verse 30. But Caleb quieted the people who were getting fidgety and discontented. What a fractious lot they were. Really, don't you think so? If you read the story over 40 years, what a carnacious, discontented lot they were. Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once. Listen to the bad news. Let's go up at once. I've told you the lovely story of the southern general in the Civil War in the United States. And the spy came back and he said, very bad news, General. I'm afraid the Northerners are in front of us and they're behind us and they're on the right-hand side and the left-hand side. We're completely surrounded. The general said, splendid. They'll never get away now. Now, that is optimism. Caleb said, listen to the bad news. Let's go up now. For it's too late and the bad news goes away. Caleb quieted the people, this carnaptious lot, before Moses and said, let us go up at once and occupy it. For we are well able to overcome it. Whether the men have long necks or not. That's the voice of faith. We turn over to chapter 14, verses 7 and 8. Joshua this time. 7 and 8. Well, verse 6. Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, rent their clothes and said to all the congregation of the people of Israel, the land which we passed through to spy it out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, He will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord. Do not fear the people of the land, because they are bread for us, and their shadow has been removed from them. And the Lord is with us. Do not fear them. It's the voice of faith. Pulling against that, the 10, oh, it's bad news. Cities with walls so high they reach the sky. These men with the long necks. And worse, they went on to tell lies. An evil report. They went on to tell lies. Said, everybody we saw was a giant. And we felt that we were grasshoppers. And they thought that we were grasshoppers. Of course, there's always that tension in our Christian hearts and experience, isn't there? Living faith militates against unfaith and doubt and uncertainty. But my Christian friend, when it comes to the choice, pessimism with unfaith at its heart, or optimism with faith at its heart, whose side are you on? Our land is filled with giants today. In the opening books of the Bible, these giants are called by different names. The Anakim, the Nephilim, the Enim, the Zamzumim, the Rephaim. Only the names have changed. The giants are still here. Did you know that some books for children in primary schools today speak openly of the demonic and the occult? Some of the plays and films now being shown on television were forbidden as recently as 10 years ago. But the climate has changed. In 10 years, the moral climate has changed. Did you know that British television is considered to be the most vulgar and bawdy in all of Europe? What some vulgar people call French bedroom scenes on the continent are called English bedroom scenes. Our land is filled with giants. Immediately after the Michael Ryan incident and those dreadful murders at Hungerford, the BBC decided not to show certain violent movies billed for the period, including Black Christmas, a fearful and a sickening film. The BBC has always denied a connection between television violence and violence in society. If the BBC believes that there is no connection between violence and television and violence in society. Why did they withdraw the films? Was that an unspoken admission that there is a connection? After all, Black Christmas has nothing in it of Rambo-style violence. So why cut it out? And I see that this week they're showing Gorky Park, which is one of the most ghastly and horrific things. And Gorky Park has a great deal in it of Rambo-style shootings in the manner of Ryan. Why don't they withdraw Gorky Park? Our land is filled with giants. Our world is filled with giants. Unfaith sees the giants, but faith sees the challenge. It is written, "The earth shall be filled with the knowledge of God as the waters cover the sea." It's the promise of God. Do you believe it? "He shall not fail, nor be discouraged," said Isaiah, writing of the coming Christ. "He shall not fail, nor be discouraged, until he has established justice in the earth." Do you believe that? Real faith, living faith, is optimistic. It claims the promises of God, and it possesses the land, and it faces the darkness with evangelical courage and evangelical hope. And it is to these that Christ calls us now. Amen. May God add a blessing to the preaching of his word.